It is with great pleasure today that MediNews welcomes Dastan Jassim and Kamal Jamani. I'm Desmond Fernandez, and today's podcast takes a look at the situation in Iraqi Kurdistan. Dastan is a research fellow at the Geiger Institute for Middle East Studies and a member of the Geiger Doctoral Programme, who's also a conflict researcher for the Heidelberg Institute for International Conflict Research on Kurdish conflicts in Iraq and Syria. She's a doctoral student at the Friedrich Alexander University, Erlangen-Nuremberg, and has also been a visiting scholar at the Center for Gender and Development Studies, CGDS, at the American University of Iraq and Silmanaya in Iraqi Kurdistan. Kamal Jamani is a Kurdish political analyst and journalist and a master's student at the Willy Brandt School of Public Policy at the University of Erfurt. Now to the focus of today's podcast. Our TV screens and news bulletins in recent days have been filled with harrowing images of desperate Kurdish and othered refugees, asylum seekers and migrants, trapped in a zone along the Belarus-Poland border, living in sub-zero conditions with few resources at their disposal. Many of those Kurdish refugees, asylum seekers and migrants have travelled from Iraqi Kurdistan. The geopolitical context in which the refugees, asylum seekers and migrants have been terrorised, as they lie trapped in a control zone along the Belarus-Poland border and have been cynically treated as pawns by various governments and supra-governmental entities such as NATO and the European Union to advance their own agendas, is the focus of a main investigative feature I've written for MediNews. But the real subject for today's podcast focuses, as I've indicated, on the human rights situation in Iraqi Kurdistan. There have been reports confirming that many of the Kurdish refugees, asylum seekers and migrants trapped in that zone along the Belarus-Poland border, as well as refugees, asylum seekers and migrants in Belarus trying to make it into Poland, have travelled from and come from Iraqi Kurdistan. When interviewed, many have stated that they were fleeing because of the lack of human rights, freedom and democracy and the high rate of unemployment in Iraqi Kurdistan. Some have stated that they, as journalists, had fled from Iraqi Kurdistan because of the extreme nature of the targeting of people engaged in their profession by the Kurdistan Regional Government, the KRG, and the Kurdistan Democratic Party, the KDP. Others reportedly stated that they were being forced to fight against the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, by the authorities, something that they were reluctant to be part of, that is, engaging on Kurd-on-Kurd violence. Certainly, it is the case, as MediNews and other news platforms have extensively reported, that freedom of the press has come under and remains under extreme attack in Iraqi Kurdistan, and journalists have a well-founded fear of being persecuted, being detained and tried without due process, and subjected to torture. Reporters Without Borders, RSF for example, has stated, and I quote, that in northern Iraq's autonomous Kurdistan region, there seems to be virtually no limits to the persecution of journalists who criticise its ruling families. They are jailed on charges of spying or endangering state security on the basis of confessions extracted under torture or by means of threats. Some journalists in the region have died in unclear circumstances, and the suspicion that the authorities were responsible is reinforced by the lack of any serious investigation into their deaths. End quote. Only last month, RSF and Metro Centre, an Iraqi Kurdish NGO that defends journalists' rights, called for the immediate release of five journalists detained in Iraqi Kurdistan, three of whom are on hunger strike in protest against the conditions in which they're being held. It is also the case, as several commentators have noted, that the KRG has mobilised against the PKK and played an accommodating role to Turkey's military operations in the region, which have been accused of perpetrating ecocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes. Turkey has been accused of employing chemical warfare and toxic gases against Kurdish fighters in conflict zones and in other areas in order to terrorise local populations into fleeing the areas they've lived in, many for generations. The subject of chemical warfare use has led to numerous protests and international appeals to the OPCW and governmental and human rights and UN-related organisations to act and initiate immediate investigations in the matter. There have also been reports of extensive deforestation in areas by the Turkish military forces. Also, in Sinjar, there have been numerous reports of intimidation of the self-governing autonomous Yazidi region and its inhabitants by Iraqi forces in the KRG, who signed the Sinjar Agreement determining the fate of the Sinjar region without consulting the Yazidi autonomous authorities or the people living there. There have also been numerous reports that the extreme corruption of the governing elites, families and parties has also stimulated a major economic and social crisis in the region that has also led to several Kurds seeking sanctuary elsewhere. There have also been mass protests against the government. The region has been ruled for decades by two parties, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the PUK, and the Kurdistan Democratic Party, the KDP. Hakim Daud Karadagi, an Iraqi Kurdish journalist and researcher, has worked for several major news and media outlets in the last 13 years in Kurdistan and written extensively on journalism, democracy, the rule of law and human rights for Iraqi international media. In May this year, expressed his fears that, and I quote, the Kurdistan region of Iraq, the KRI, is on the verge of becoming completely ruled by two powerful families. It is an incontrovertible fact that the quality of democracy and respect for the rule of law have declined in recent years. For instance, the protests that erupted in early December 2020 have descended into violence as security forces used live bullets to end it, killing at least 9 young protesters and injuring hundreds more. In a wave of similar protests in 2011 and 2015, dozens of protesters were killed without a single perpetrator being brought to justice. In terms of respecting and abiding by the rule of law, he noted, Kurdistan cannot be compared even to the central government of Baghdad. The president of Kurdistan, Masoud Barzani, refused to abide by the two-term limit and extended his presidency twice. His nephew, the current president, Nashavan Barzani, was also the prime minister for almost 20 years. His eldest son, Masroor, is now the premier. On the other side of the aisle, the wife, sons and nephews of the late Iraqi president and PUK Secretary General Jalal Talabani have firm control of top positions as well. End quote. Karadagi concluded that, and I quote, over the last 3 decades, the KRG has been criticised and condemned by international human rights groups and media watchdogs for killing, torturing and arresting journalists, political activists and protesters. But matters have gone from bad to worse since Masroor Barzani, the third generation of Barzanis, became the Prime Minister in 2019. His tribal and conservative background, plus his roles as Chief Intelligence and Top Security Officer in the region, have ensured that under Masroor's leadership, there is now zero tolerance to critical voices and decent people who are fighting against corruption, nepotism, repression and social injustice in the region. In the demonstrations of last December, dozens of protesters were killed and many more injured. 24 journalists and protest organisers still remain behind bars without legal charges brought against them. The majority are put in secret prisons in Erbil and Duhok, where the armed forces are under direct control of the Barzanis. Major opposition media outlets are shut down in Sulaimani and Erbil, where around 50 foreign consulates are operating but are not raising concerns about the situation. Even the lawmakers with legal immunity are not protected from criticising the Prime Minister Barzani. End quote. Whilst these types of concerns have been raised, opposing views have been raised by the governing elites. And in response to some of these reported assertions by the Kurdish refugees, asylum seekers and migrants, it was reported just this past week that the representative of the Kurdistan Regional Government, the KRG, in Poland, Ziad Rauf, accused Kurdish migrants on the Belarus-Poland border of telling falsehoods to European officials that have harmed the reputation of the KRG. Rauf reportedly told The Voice of America that he had heard from the Polish authorities and European observers about what the migrants were telling officials to justify their emigration. He characterised their stated reasons for fleeing Iraqi Kurdistan as inaccurate and unfair. He claimed that some of the migrants said that they're journalists who will be arrested and tortured if they stay in the Kurdistan region, and that others said that the Kurdistan Democratic Party, the KDP, had forced them to fight against the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. They have fabricated many other stories that the mind does not accept, he added, seemingly referring to claims that the refugees and migrants and asylum seekers were fleeing Iraqi Kurdistan due to the severe repression and persecution they faced, and or the extremely dire economic circumstances they're being forced to live in. Now, both of you, Dastan and Kamal, I know are seasoned observers of the situation in Iraqi Kurdistan. What are your takes regarding the situation? And once again, thank you so much for joining us on the programme today.
Okay, thank you very much for having us. And I'm happy that, you know, we are with Dastan and with you this morning. We are talking about a very crucial and sensitive situation. And you are very lengthy and very appropriate like preface about the situation is really, really, I can just confirm the majority what you said that's happening in Kurdistan. And however, if we just, you know, focus more on the situation on the border and the refugees that they are, you know, trying to take refuge in one of the European countries, and also the accusations by the KRG officials, be at home or, you know, at the in Europe, including the KRG representative in Polish, you know, they are just all these baseless lies and also insulting the refugees and the people who are fleeing the injustice, repressive and oppressive reign of the KRG led by the specifically Barzani family and also the Talabani families. And, you know, as you said, the situation in Kurdistan economically and politically is really, really in a very bad and difficult situation, which had led the people to flee the Kurdistan region of Iraq. And unfortunately, in the past, let's say 100 years, the Kurdish people have been fleeing their homeland due to oppressive rules of non-Kurdish oppressors, non-Kurdish repressive rules by the you know, central governments in Ankara, in Tehran, in Baghdad, and also in Damascus. However, in the past 30 years, the people in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, they are fleeing the Kurdistan region due to a Kurdish repressive rule, which they are like a small political elite, including the top political leadership of the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, as well as the two main families, the Barzani family and the Talabani family. They are not representing the Kurdish population in the Kurdistan region. And you know, just to prove that, the recent election in the Kurdistan region, just less than 40% participated in the elections. So since 1991, people are fleeing the Kurdistan region due to the repressive reign of the Kurdish rulers back home. And for the past 30 years, this situation, this migration and taking refuge in other countries has been continuing without any real, any real policies by the KRG to address the problems back home, so that those problems will not force people to leave the Kurdistan region anymore. Which I, you know, the main problems are political and economical, which we discuss, you know, in during our discussion. I will leave for Dastan to have her observations.
Yeah, thank you so much. I can only second what you, Desmond, and what Kamal said. I think the situation of southern Kurds, Iraqi Kurds, is very telling as to how reasons to look for refuge are going to look like in the future. Because in the Kurdistan region, you have a number of different aspects and different problems that are coming together that make people flee the region. It's not like there is just one thing, there is one war. I think there is an archetypical image of refugees that is being presented as what a good refugee has to be. For example, someone who just, you know, literally just fled like a drone attack, or someone who just fled from some bomb attack. But that's not how taking refuge, looking for refuge, is going to look like in the future. In the Kurdistan region, we also have a, you know, variety of reasons that come together as Kamal already mentioned, we have a party duopoly that has not created any sustainability, any jobs, any progress, or any real institution building in the last 30 years. Although people have been very patient, I have to really cite my mother here, for example, who often says, you know, in the 90s, when the Kurdistan region was established as an autonomy, and, you know, there was a very strong sanctions program on the Kurdistan region, you know, teachers and public servants would work for free. Because, you know, they believed in the cause, they believed in what is possible. They were believing in an outlook of a post-Saddam Kurdistan, where all of their work would pay out, you know. People were willing to do so much and to put so much on the line for this autonomy. The more it is hurtful that it has developed to become what it is. Also, what it comes into play is that we have huge problems because of climate change and global capitalism in the region. Obviously, the Kurdistan region has been designed after the Iraq war to simply be a cheap market where you can get the surplus produce of Turkey and Iran to be sold, and for these countries to have a good trade route. Nothing more than that. There has been no attempts to really push for production, to really make Kurdistan region a economically autonomous region, and not only autonomous in the sense of oil. If you look at it, the kind of economy that has been built and the kind of economy that was about to be built in order for Kurdistan region to try to get independent was only a rentier-based economy. And it was obvious that if the oil price is going to crash down, if you have something like the refugee crisis after 2014 and all of these things, that, you know, public servant salaries cannot be paid, and that this kind of corrupt system is going to eventually crash. The system has been corrupt before, but the situation was simply that economically they could afford to be corrupt because they could buy enough people for them to support them. Climate change is also very important because we have a huge drought in all of Iraq, we have to say. It's a big problem in both Syria and Iraq. We have a great lack of water. We also have the Turkish drone war, especially in the northern corner of the Kurdistan region. We have massive deforestation that is happening there, allegedly because, you know, they want to make the air clear. They want to make the space clear to fight PKK. And these are all the areas where especially the rural population in the Kurdistan region, which already has a hard time selling their crops, selling their produce, because it's much more expensive than Turkish and Iranian produce, that they are also forced to flee the region because of both the drone war and because of the destruction of nature. And also we have a huge amount of, you know, dam projects of both Turkey and Iran that are also keeping the water flow away from the Kurdistan region. So this is not only symptomatic of Kurdistan region, this is what this world is going to look at in the future and is at looking at right now. It's a combination of factors from global capitalism, exploitation, corruption, climate change, and the massive also disregard for young people. We also shouldn't forget that we have a huge youth bulge in the Kurdistan region and Iraq in general, and no one has really calculated for them. No one has really thought about how are these people going to get a job? Is there going to be an economy? We have teacher strikes for the last 3 years. The public salaries could not be paid for the last 3 years properly, and a lot of teachers are striking. And for the last 3 years, the average school year has been several months shorter than the normal school year. So now imagine how this is for elementary school kids in the Kurdistan region that are learning reading and writing and essential things in this time, and that is cut by several months. So that means that we're not only having a problem of, you know, economic issues, but we also have a huge educational problem. And for most Kurdish people, the question is really about what place are my children going to live in? And what people really need to understand, there is a lot of voices out there. You have already cited, you know, the representations from KRG, but also what several other representations are saying. The issue is not that it's impossible to live in the Kurdistan region. That is not the issue. The issue is that life in the Kurdistan region is a gamble. You have to gamble for your future. You have no security in health, no security in education. And anyone who might be listening who has kids on their own knows that this kind of security is the first and foremost thing that you think about when you're raising your own children. And that's exactly what these refugees have been thinking about. And when people are saying, you know, how does this money come? How do they have this money? And I don't know what. It's easy to save money. These are people that have saved money for years and years and years for this. This is an investment that they're taking, a very heavy investment that they're taking to try to make a better life, to try to make a future in a system where people can hardly live anymore. And people really have to understand that, that this is the type of, you know, this is the type of collection of reasons to flee the region that we're looking at, and that it's not only one big thing. And we have to be really honest. We can, you know, we can discuss about whether it's safe to do that. You know, we can discuss about smugglers. We should talk about smugglers. It's obvious that there is a huge smuggling system in the Kurdistan region. There is a huge border smuggling system. There is a smuggling system when it comes to refugees. These systems are very criminal. These systems are often working with political elites. We have to talk about these things. But there would be no request for smugglers if there was not this political and economic situation in the Kurdistan region.
Well, thank you very much for that, because obviously what you're highlighting is just a total lack of security in terms of what people feel the existing and future life can be. Kamal, I don't know if you could also expand on the security situation. I know, Dastan, thank you very much for that, for really highlighting the real fears which a lot of the refugees have. And of course, as we know, they're now really being used as pawns along the border, zoned off, and in many cases being presented as a security threat. You know, it's something which I've covered elsewhere, that various politicians are referring to the Kurdish refugee problem as justifying bringing in Article 4 of NATO, which really is then being used in a wider geopolitical scene to create, you know, the conflict obviously between NATO, the EU, versus Russia and its supposed allies. But beyond that, really, thank you for highlighting these very real concerns. As you say, these are real people like you and I, in a sense, having these very realistic reasons and genuine reasons to try and get a better life. Kamal, I don't know if you could just highlight, you know, what Dastan was saying, that there have been lots of protests. You've got the teachers not being paid, other government or other workers in government service not being paid. And obviously there were quite a few protests over this where there was a very heavy-handed crackdown. And again, as a journalist yourself, I'm sure you would know, I don't know if you could highlight the very real situation facing journalists as well, and also the security situation in terms of the KRG security services. There are lots of reports that if anyone questions all the types of things you've highlighted there, Dastan, the security forces just come and clamp down. So the issue of freedom of expression, the issue of trying to genuinely reach out to the government to address all the types of issues you're talking about there in terms of economic security, security for families, the way Turkish military forces operations in the region, and as you say, in a capitalistic sense, cheaper goods coming in and really undercutting all the produce and all the goods of people in rural areas trying to sell it, and at the same time being displaced by Turkish military forces, many people say conducting an ecocide in terms of extensive deforestation of the regions. Kamal, I don't know if you could just comment on these issues, because I know it's something which you're closely familiar with. And also, sorry, just the issue of reasons where some rural peoples might have left because of, well, within the areas where Turkish forces are also operating. Over to you, Kamal.
Yeah, so I think, you know, Dastan, and you didn't leave anything for me to add. However, you know, just a few things. And concerning the security situation in Kurdistan, first of all, we should question who has the right to use violence, or let's say who has control over the security forces and the army in the Kurdistan region. So the security situation in Kurdistan, we have, in theory, we have security forces, we have police, we have the Peshmerga forces. However, none of these, neither the security forces, nor the police, nor the Peshmerga, nor the Asayish or security forces are taking command from the government. And like the Peshmerga is, you know, it is divided between the KDP and PUK. The Asayish security forces divided again, KDP, PUK, the anti-terror again, and also including the police. Even the police is divided. Even the police in Erbil is different from the police in Sulaymaniyah. And when you are in a situation where the arms are in the hands of the militias and the political parties, so in this situation, none of the citizens are secured in the Kurdistan region. And the ones who are using violence, the ones who has the power to use the violence or to command of using arms or using, you know, security in the Kurdistan region, again, are the top political politicians or the political families in the Kurdistan region, Talabani and Barzani family again. In this situation, as I said, no one in Kurdistan is secured. And let's give some examples. We have had protests like many other countries in the region, but the protests have always been tracked down. Like being 17 February 2011, that, you know, a major Kurdish sort of Kurdish Spring, you know, influenced by the Arab Spring also, started in Sulaymaniyah and then it was cracked down. It continued for about 63 days and then eventually 10 our protesters were killed, 500 wounded, hundreds were arrested and tens were exiled. And then this situation continued. And let's just give, you know, another example in 2015 when the Speaker of Parliament from the opposition party who wanted to legally discuss about the presidential law. At that time, Masoud Barzani was the president of Kurdistan and his term had already been extended for 2 years. And the Speaker of Parliament wanted to discuss the presidential law and resolve the presidential crisis in the Kurdistan region. However, what happened, because the security forces, the Peshmerga, the police, everything belongs to the political party or the political families. So he was forced to leave Erbil. And then the day after, when he wanted to re-enter Erbil, he was denied. And for 2 years, even the Speaker of Parliament, he was not able to enter Erbil. He was able to go any countries around the world, any capitals around the world. And he had a lot of, you know, travelers in Europe, including one of the meetings at the UK Parliament. However, he was not allowed to go to Erbil. So if the building of the parliament is not secure for the Speaker of Parliament, how we can talk about the security for other people? And recently, like last 2 years, there were some protests in Duhok. Again, as you mentioned, and Dasan as well, in terms of public servants were not paid in full and on time. So people protested. There were two separate protests. First, one protest was against the Turkish military bases in the Kurdistan region, that the Turkish military bases are in Kurdistan region due to their connection and alliance with the KDP, and Barzani family. And those people in Shiladze, that the Turkish strikes had killed the civilians, they protested against the military base. So the KDP arrested them, kidnapped them, and put them in jail. And those who were not kidnapped, who were not arrested, and then they were able to flee the Kurdistan region. And now the Kurdistan region head of the foreign department wants to accuse the PKK to be behind the refugee influx on the border. And then there were some protests that some journalists and also activists joined them, where they also asked for their monthly salaries. And then again, they were processed. And now they are in prison, 80 of them, journalists and activists, very close friends of mine as well. And some journalists, six journalists have already been, I think six have been, sentenced. Some others are convicted and the trials are illegal. And the trials are also continuing. For what? On charges? So Masrur Barzani, as the prime minister of the Kurdistan region, he's fabricated some lies and some baseless charges for these people, for the protesters, for the activists and journalists, including that, you know, they had some talks with some meetings with the German and U.S. consulates, and which is something any journalist, including me, have done lots of times in Erbil, because there are diplomatic missions in Erbil. So we talk for, you know, they want to know what's going on in Kurdistan. And we also want to know what's going on between the Kurdistan region and also the other countries, and all this aid that comes to Kurdistan that's supporting the Kurdistan. Sometimes we just want to deliver our concerns and our people's concerns about the situation that this aid, like many people, many journalists have always focused on. This is very important, this like partnership or alliance or relations, whatever you call it. But it should be conditional. It should not serve the KDP and PUK, because it will further help them to establish their authoritarian rule. As we see right now, people are fleeing from this authoritarianism of the KDP and PUK, especially the KDP. And the security situation has always been like this. And imagine, it's not only for the Kurdish citizens, also for the Kurdish, I don't want to call them refugees, but let's say to better understand, the Kurdish refugees that they have taken refugee because of the Iranian oppression and Turkish oppression, they live in Kurdistan region, so they are being assassinated and they have been attacked. So Iranian missiles have attacked the Kurdish refugees in Koya. The Turkish military, the Turkish airstrikes, they have attacked, they have bombed the Kurdish refugees in Mahmur area. And now Mahmur camp, which is a UN-recognized camp, they are not allowed to enter Erbil, even to go to the hospitals, because the KDP is just following what Turkey is telling them. And the Kurdish refugees in Iran, the Kurdish Iranian refugees in Koya and other areas, the majority of them are in the PUK area. They are being assassinated. They are not being able to do their activities. So the situation is like, you know, the security situation is really, really dire for not only the Kurdish citizens, but for all the people. And look at the border areas. The border areas are being bombed and shelled, bombed, and the Turkish and the Turkish airstrikes are continuing. They have already occupied a swath of the Kurdistan region. And who is behind that? Okay, Turkey is doing that, but neither the Iraqi government, nor the Iraqi parliament, nor the Kurdish parliament, nor the Iraqi people, nor the Kurdish people are supporting those airstrikes. However, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, KDP, is supporting that. And those who are opposing the Turkish airstrikes or the Iranian bombings are being oppressed and persecuted. So all this situation together is creating this refugee influx in the Kurdistan region, and many people are leaving the Kurdistan region. And just imagine the border areas that they were always relied on themselves, including economically as well. But now they are coming to the cities, to the towns, and then no jobs, no economic opportunities. So what they should do? Some of them, if they are able, they will leave Kurdistan. And the problem is, including those reasons and dimensions that Dastan talked, the problem is there's no KRG policies where we can address the situation, these problems and this crisis. That's the main issue, because everything is connected to politics in Kurdistan, including the economics. Dastan talked about this international globalization. In the meantime, the privatization in the Kurdistan is continuing, and it, to an extent, like, you know, right now there are, it's hard to differentiate between the public good and the private good. And the two political parties, the two families are using the public good as their, you know, as their private good. And that's why, just to give an example, there was one of the universities in Erbil, which is called Kurdistan University, which was a public university, but just they privatized, and it belongs to the son of president, who is now the chancellor of the university. We don't know even he has BA or not, and including, like, each politician, they have their own hospitals. They have the, look at the PUK, which calls themselves that they are social democrats, but they have established the Kosrat Rasul, who is the head of the PUK Supreme Council, and he was the deputy of Talabani as well. He established a hospital in Erbil on public good, and now it's a private private hospital. And this privatization has created a situation where there is a lot of inequality in Kurdistan region, and people feel that this inequality. You know, people cannot afford anything, cannot afford, as Dastan said, you know, health and education, et cetera, et cetera. And people say that two generation, you know, one of our generation, the generation of our parents became the victims of Saddam Hussein. Our generation became the victims of this current Kurdish government and rule. And why our children should become the victims if there are another opportunity in terms of security, economy, politically, then let's leave, no matter how the situation is hard in Agency or on the borders of Belarus and Poland.
Well, really, thank you very much there. And I was just wondering, Kamal and Dastan, if you'll have any views or perspectives also about the Sinjar agreement. Has that really affected people in the area? As stated, many people there in the autonomous administration there have argued that they weren't consulted over the Sinjar agreement. And many of them obviously had fears that if the KRG or the KDP's forces or the Iraqi forces are sent in to keep security in the area, these are the very forces which failed in a major way to provide any security to the Yazidis when ISIS came through and went ahead with a whole genocidal conflict. What are your views there? Because again, Dastan, I know you're talking about any families would be thinking about the security of their children and of the wider families. When you've had a situation where a genocide has taken place in such horrific circumstances for the Yazidis, where they felt that the institutional state mechanisms failed them just a few years ago, if you now have those same institutional mechanisms, which both of you have highlighted are also highly corrupt and very partial in terms of who they choose to protect or oppress. If you have those forces put in charge of protecting the Yazidis in an area there, again, what would people feel in terms of security, the Yazidis there, in that context? I don't know if Yolka could comment on that, to see whether Yolka see that as a major situation which would affect how people, Yazidis in particular, would feel about either staying in the area or moving out of the area or actually choosing to oppose the nature of the Sinjar agreement. It'd be just useful to have your both your perspectives on that, and thank you so much.
Well, the issue with Shangar is very, very complicated, and I think we should have a very honest discussion about it. The problem in Shangar and all these other areas, disputed areas, from the start of this new Iraqi Republic has been the non-implementation of Article 140. Quite frankly, and especially in the Nineveh Plains, where you were supposed by the constitution, you were supposed to have a census, you are supposed to have, an idea of who is living there, who is doing what, to have a referendum on what part of Iraq they want to belong to, whether they want to be a region on their own. All these kind of things were simply delayed from 2005 on. And you don't have to be a Kurdish nationalist. You don't have to be a KDP supporter to just know that. That's a basic constitutional fact. This has been slept on. So all of this being like that, being untouched, this problem being untouched, and then the genocide coming has been the worst case scenario. And it simply happened. That is what we're in right now. And also, what we can also not deny is that there is a significant amount of Yazidi families and Yazidi tribes, you may call them bribed or anything, but they are on the side of KDP. So we don't even have one united front when it comes to that. But also, clearly, Yazidis are a victim to this power game, right? I'm not saying that they decided to one side go with them, one side go with them, but this is a very, very nasty power game, which is really to the expense of the Yazidis, because they are in a post-genocide situation where they want to just be safe. And depending on what area you are in, I mean, when we're talking about these northern areas of Nineveh, that's a very politically ambivalent area. You have some areas where you have strong KDP control. You have some areas where you have Iraqi army control. And we shouldn't forget, we have some areas where you have strong Hashd al-Shaabi control. That's not a partner you want to have anyways. I don't think that pro-Iranian militias are going to be the one that are going to defend Iraqi minorities. We should remember that too, especially now that Iranian militias are actively attacking all kinds of areas in Baghdad and all kinds of other cities. Iranian militias have been shooting on the youth of the Tashrin revolution and all these kind of things. That's stuff that we have to keep in mind. The issue in the end is that we have had and now still have a lack of institutionalization for these areas. We have a lack of responsibility. And it has always been like that with the 140 areas, with these disputed areas. When the political elites want to claim it, they claim it. When they want to get the people, get their votes, get their support, they're doing something. They're building a bridge. They're doing I don't know what. They travel there. But then they leave. It's no man's land. That is the specific reason why ISIS sleeper cell attacks are the strongest in these areas. These people are suffering from many, many, many levels of political and military problematics. But now we don't only have the institutional problem, we have the security problem. We have a bazillion armed forces in this area. So the problem really is not only the Erbil like the Sinjar agreement and the Erbil Baghdad agreement on that. Erbil and Baghdad are just minor players in this game. The whole thing is about Turkish influence and Iranian influence. That's the big thing about it, and that is the greater picture that we have to look at. Unfortunately, really unfortunately, a ethnic and religious group that has been the biggest victim of ISIS is the victim of this power play right now. But the more it is important for us when we're analyzing these things to look at the pre-2014 time, which is the time in which Iraq and the Kurdistan region have had the possibility to really establish what is said in the constitution. They did not. They were busy, you know, privatizing the whole country, as Kamal already said, letting in all kinds of shady businesses, just being engaged in that. And now after ISIS, everyone is paying for this. Specifically, the Yazidi people are paying for this. So we cannot know how this deal is playing out without knowing what in the long term Iranian and Turkish power is going to look like. And that is depending on how the negotiations in Vienna are going. That is depending on how the U.S.-Turkey relationship is going to look like. That is going to be depending on whether Turkey is going to be able to pull through with their two-year Iraq and Syria plan, where they agreed to, you know, extend the involvement, military involvement there. That is the whole sphere where this whole agreement is really playing out. And unfortunately, neither KRG nor Baghdad are strong enough to be strong players. They are being used in this game. And I'm not taking their responsibility. Clearly, a lot of politicians want to be used in that game because they want to have support. They want to have control. This is something that is as old as Iraqi Kurdish history, that specific political actors are using foreign actors to win in the domestic struggle. But that should not keep us away from keeping our analysis and our view very widely and very openly, and looking and, you know, bringing in all regional issues. And also, I really have to say one thing about the PKK argument that you already talked about before, Kamal and Desmond. The irony is that back in the 2010s, Nechirvan Barzani was one of the key players when it came to the negotiations between PKK and the Turkish state. He presented himself as someone who was willing to put both sides on the table, support them, to work with, you know, the HDP delegation, to work with all of these people to bring about the 2013 peace agreement. And the peace agreement said, and I have already argued this, the peace agreement said the PKK is supposed to go to the Kandil Mountains. They are supposed to leave Turkish areas. And now they are there. They did exactly what is said in that agreement. And now the same Kurdish, Iraqi Kurdish political elites are saying, what are they doing here? Why are they not fighting in Turkey? That's a typical sentence that they always say. Well, you brokered an agreement where this was part of the agreement. So, you know, there is a lot of misinformation, disinformation going on around these kind of things, around these kind of agreements. But, you know, we have to put these things into perspective at the end of the day.
Thank you so much. And Kamal, I don't know if you had any further comments on that.
I don't have much, you know, to add. However, you know, when we talk about the Shingal agreement is something, and when we talk about the Yazidi situation and what sort of, you know, agreement the Yazidis and Shingal areas should have is a different story. For me, the Shingal agreement is an illegitimate agreement. As Dastan said, is an agreement that addresses the interests of the regional powers rather than the people's interests in the region. And even in the Erbil, it's, you know, Erbil is part of the agreement, but Erbil as the KDP is part of the agreement, not as the Kurdistan region. And the ones who have been consulted in the Kurdistan region are the KDP, and the ones who are implementing, they want to, the implementation of the agreement, again, is the KDP. It has nothing to do with the PUK, nothing to do with the change movement and the other opposition parts in the parliament, including the Kurdish people. And when it comes to the Yazidis have not been consulted. And the UN, and that they also presented the agreement, is just, you know, has never been to Shingal to talk to people what these people want. And it is true, there are also the people who are supporting the KDP, who are in the refugees, and they are completely controlled by the KDP. They may have a different idea. Like, they may also want the implementation of Shingal agreement. But you cannot ignore like half of the people who are ruling, the real power de facto in the region. And then you can just go and talk to the people, like the leaders and the governments, that they left the people in Shingal and they faced a genocide. And that's something for me, like the agreement itself is illegitimate, is something serving the interests of some internal parties and families, as well as the regional powers. And with the Yazidis, like, you know, if we talk about what sort of what sort of policy or, you know, agreement it should serve, then it's something different. And I think no matter whether we have had Article 140 in the Iraqi constitution that should be implemented in, to decide on the future of the disputed areas, it's something like, it's amazing in theory. However, in practice, it should have been implemented back in 2007, and it was never implemented. And now we have a new paradigm. We have a new situation, especially in the Shingal area. And in Shingal area, a new paradigm should be there. And the Yazidis, they should decide for themselves. And they should decide for themselves at a situation when their areas are normalized, there's normalcy, there's security. At that point, the Yazidis by themselves, they should decide for themselves. Neither the Kurdish government nor the Iraqi Shia, Arab, Sunni government should decide on behalf of the Yazidis. at least, you know, after they have faced it, they faced a genocide, and neither the Kurdish Peshmerga nor the Iraqi, let's say, Arab Sunni and Shia, you know, army in Mosul protected them. So it's time for them to decide on for themselves. And in the Shingal Agreement, there was no Yazidis. There were some Yazidis that they are supported by the KDP. And that's something, for me, it's completely rejected. That's why, for me, this agreement is was something further, like, you know, created more problems than resolving the problems. And for the future, okay, there should be, the Yazidis should be consulted, an agreement that should serve the interests of the Yazidis. And at that point, I think both sides and all the sides, the Iraqi government, the Erbil or the KDP government, as well as the people or the security forces and like the protection units that are close to the PKK, they should compromise. None of the ideas of the KDP, PKK, or the Iraqi government can be alone implemented there. And I think at that time, if there will not be compromise among all the parties or the stakeholders there, I think we will just lead the Yazidis to have a sort of internal conflict. Is more in, and to an extent, they may even have, you know, armed clashes among themselves. And at that time, as a Kurd, as an Iraqi, as a Kurd, as someone who's from Kurdistan region, I feel so bad at that point, because, you know, it will be us, the Kurdish government, the Iraqi government, that both there, you know, in both government, the Kurdish people are represented. We are living, we are like, instead of getting, like, saving the Yazidis from another genocide, from another tragedy, we will just lead them to another tragedy. And at that point, you know, the PKK, the KDP, and the Iraqi government will be the main responsible for another tragedy that may happen in the future.
Well, really, thank you so much, Kamal and Dastan. I don't know if you would like to add any further comments, but the perspectives you'll have raised, I know will have really had a lot of our listeners thinking on some quite serious issues. And really, the key issues there about the desperate circumstances and situation in Iraqi Kurdistan itself, which are, you know, as you all have highlighted, are affected not just by two key parties' political control of the area, but the way in which globalization, wider regional dynamics and powers have been involved in creating this really desperate situation for so many people living in Iraqi Kurdistan. And of course, it hopefully really provides really deep insights into a lot of the unfortunate refugees who are currently being terrorized, really, along that border area by all sorts of different forces and, you know, as we know, being used as pawns in wider geopolitical struggles, just really as many of the Kurdish people are being used as part of wider geopolitical strategies and imperialist or even paleo-imperialist agendas of the regional powers and the global powers in Iraqi Kurdistan or around Iraqi Kurdistan. Once again, really, thank you so much for your contributions.